Okay.
Okay. Just to give a bit of background about Lake Like a Mirror, then it's a collection of short stories, of nine short stories. And each one sort of centers around a woman who is either in Malaysia or from Malaysia. And I think Xu Feng, the author, describes it as being a book about characters that are in liminal states. So they're all kind of waiting to do something, but for some reason kind of prevented from doing it. So nothing is ever quite completed, I think. And I think that's kind of the thread that runs through all the stories. So there's one story which is, for example, about a university professor who is constantly on edge and worried that she's about to lose her job because she'll say something that goes against the regulations of the university. And in the story, it's because she, in one class, lets a student read out loud a poem by E.E. Cummings. And this poem, this student then makes a video that he puts online where he reads the poem and also comes out as gay. So the university accuse her of promoting homosexuality. So she's sort of on edge about whether she'll be able to keep her job after that. And another two stories in the collection are both about these mixed race Malay Chinese girls that are in Islamic reform institutions because they have to be Muslim because they're half Malay. And by law in Malaysia, all anyone who's even slightly Malay has to be Muslim. And you can apply to leave Islam, but you're normally rejected and then sent into these reform institutions. So these girls are kind of in limbo because they don't know when they're going to get out of the institutions and they don't know what their lives will look like afterwards. So I thought for the reading, then I would just do a really short reading from the title story, which is Lake Like a Mirror. And that's the one I just described about the university lecturer. And this is taken from kind of towards the end of the story when she has realized that she probably won't lose her job because the attention of the university has switched from being on her to being about another professor in the university who did something worse than she did because she discussed the Islamic dress code for women in a class and was then accused of being disrespectful of the Quran. So in this scene, then the protagonist is giving a ride home to this woman after the news of her kind of departure has broken in the university. One thing to note is that nobody has a name in this story, which definitely made it quite hard to translate because there were a lot of she pronouns floating around, but hopefully you can more or less follow the reading even so. So for the whole car journey, she felt her attention drawn to her left. They didn't exactly know each other, but neither were they complete strangers. Their offices were a few rooms apart, and they'd often passed one another in the corridor, gone to the same meetings, waited for one another to hand over their teaching groups. And now the woman was being singled out as an example. It was hard to fathom. She knew she should keep quiet, was aware the woman wasn't in the best mood, but they still had an hour to go. She started chatting about this and that, making fun of some stupid TV show, complaining about public transport being as crap as ever. Then a press conference came on the radio and they both fell silent, listening as someone attacks the administration for being a festering pile of rubbish. "What will you do next?" she asked from the driver's seat. Her passenger shrugged. "I don't know." "What did they say to you?" "Oh, they're smarter about these things now. It was all very civilized. They said my contract was up, that courses are being restructured and the faculty is moving in a new direction, so my services are no longer required. They didn't mention anything about student complaints." "Oh, so that's how they played it. I guess you can't argue with that." "Argue with what? Argue that I'm the victim here, because that's not what I want." "Things were more complicated than that," she added. "Much more complicated than that." The after-work traffic was like a tide. Car after car after car stretching along the outer ring road, all six lanes blocked like a huge outdoor car park. Horns blasted impatiently. The cars inched forward, queuing for the better part of an hour just to pass through the toll booth. In the shimmer of the setting sun, they were part of a sea that stretched all the way to the horizon. "I might apply to go abroad if I can find a course," said the woman, without much enthusiasm. "What about you? Things are fine now, I take it. You can stay." She gave a small hesitant nod and then shook her head. "I don't know. I hope so. I really hope so." Her voice was strained. I saw the video and it's nothing to do with you. Some people just love to talk shit, said the woman. English literature has nothing to do with it. They have nothing better to do than intimidate people and try to make examples of them. She listened silently, at a loss for words. She was sure that the woman was speaking the truth. But what was true had nothing whatsoever to do with what was safe. The two things were miles apart. Truth was further from safety than two islands at opposite ends of the earth. Okay, and that's the end of that reading.
Should I ask questions now?
Yes, go ahead. Yes, sorry, I was going to prompt you, but I wasn't sure if you were looking for your questions.
Okay, I'm so excited to do this. I have so many questions to ask you, but I hope I can ask them all. My first question is, as you mentioned, this is a book about women. Because all the protagonists in the nine stories are women, and the author is also a woman. So do you think that influenced the way that you translate the book?
Well, I think I have two separate answers to this question. So for anyone watching, then Junyan sent me the questions a few days ago, so I have had time to think about them. And when I first read that question, then my instinctive answer was to want to say no. And I really wanted to say that no, the gender of the author and the protagonists and my gender doesn't affect my translation, because I don't like to think that I could only translate books that, well, I like to think that I could translate books written by authors of other genders with a whole range of protagonists, and for example, even protagonists that are not human. So I worry that it would be kind of dangerous to say that we have to match translators to their books and the subject matter of the books. Because I guess for all sorts of reasons, then my experience of being female in the world is really different to the experience of Shufang, the author of this book. I definitely do think that it's true that I gravitate towards books that have been written by non-cis males, both because I feel that I feel strongly about that as a kind of political and artistic choice, and also because I think non-cis male perspectives on the world just resonate with me more, regardless of the subject matter. But that was the first part of my answer. And then I thought, okay, well, let me sit with this question a bit more, because I mean, you're not asking, do I think you can only translate books by women? You're asking if my gender affected how I translated. And when I was thinking about that some more, then I did keep coming back to a scene in one of the stories, which is the last one in the book and is called March in a Small Town. And in this scene, then the protagonist, who's a young teenage girl, is stalking this man through the town, and he goes into a cinema, and then she's waiting for him outside, and she gets a drink. So she sips her drink, and then a few lines later, she suddenly says, oh, I've got a cramp. I shouldn't have had a cold drink on my period. And that line, I absolutely think that it would be possible to have never had a period in your life, and of course, translate that line perfectly and do a brilliant job of the story. But it was a line that made me suddenly think about all the times that Chinese friends have told me, oh, you shouldn't have cold things on your period, and feel kind of connected to the character. And I think it really, just the line really stood out, because it's not connected to anything around it. Periods don't come up anywhere else in the book. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about why the line was even there. And that really led me to think that even though menstruation isn't key to the story, puberty is really key to the story. And this idea of only just getting used to having an adult body is basically the central thread, I think. And when I realized that, then I did feel that this quite strange, ambiguous story, it was like I was suddenly peeling back kind of a layer over the top of it. And then I had this new understanding of it. So I don't think it changed the way I translated it, but I definitely changed the way I've read the story. And I definitely don't think that someone else couldn't, through a different path, have arrived at the same thought, even if they hadn't had a period. But in that particular moment, then I felt like my gender and the gender of the protagonist were having a, well, there was a connection there, I suppose.
Okay. I think you have perfectly answered my question. And I have a very specific one. I noticed that the language used by the author is quite simple but clear. And I think this feature has been perfectly maintained in your translation. So my question is, did you try to cut out the unnecessary words when you were revising, because you know, I think most of her language is very, very concise. And I can think of an example right now. The Chinese is 到底一个人失踪要多久后警察才不会找了? And my first, if I were to translate this sentence, my first attempt would be very long sentence, like how long does it take before the police stop looking for a man who went missing, something like that. But your translation is very, very concise. And if you put into the context, you can perfectly understand the meaning of it. So did you try to revise it time after time and try to cut out the superfluous words?
Well, yes, it is a short answer. I definitely revised this book many, many times. I think that the line that you are quoting is from a story called Radio Drama. And I think it's also a piece of dialogue. And that story is just this, it has this very gossipy tone because it's just a story about middle-aged ladies in a hair salon. So I think in that story, especially then, I tried to be really conscious of the fact that most of what they were saying was being spoken. So it felt like it was really important to kind of echo the pacing that Shufang had put in the story. So yeah, that did require a lot of editing and kind of reading aloud and trying to make sure that it moved properly.
Yes, my next question is also from the radio drama, and I noticed that there are some dialects in radio drama, like Hokkien and Malay, and some of them I can't understand myself. And I also noticed that there are also some dialects in the story October. So and I realized that you maybe use different method or approach towards the translation of dialects. So do you think I think it's really difficult when we are facing with the translation of dialects. Do you think it's possible to translate different dialects into a different language? Or what is your approach when you encountering such situations?
I have many different things I would like to say in response to this question. I will say, first of all, that I hope that Yachi asked Nikki this question too, because I believe that Nikki's book contained a lot of Sichuan dialects, so I think she probably also has many interesting things to say. I think the first thing that is important to think about with this book is that it's a book that is written by a Malaysian writer and is set in Malaysia. And I think in Malaysia, there's this kind of incredible hybridity to the language, regardless of what language is being spoken. So when people speak English in Malaysia, they use a lot of Malay and they use a lot of Hokkien words, and the same with Chinese people speaking Chinese in Malaysia. So there is this sort of general sense of lots of words being, lots of different languages of words being used at the same time. And in a way that meant that when I was translating the stories, in some instances, the author, Shufang, she had already done a lot of the work for me because she had already had to find ways to incorporate dialects into her Chinese or incorporate Malay into her Chinese. So she had kind of set a precedent for me. So for example, in radio drama, she includes a lot of things where the narrator says, I said in Malay, or I said in Indonesian accented Malay. So that part was already there. I just had to translate what she had written. And in other stories, she does just use Malay words. And I thought that it was really important that we kept the Malay words and that we didn't explain them and that we didn't italicize them. So when she uses words like azan, that mean the call to prayer in the morning, or pasar, which would be the market where people go shopping. Also in English that's spoken in Malaysia, people use those words all the time. So I felt that we would just put them in the story and hope that a reader would kind of become familiar with them by the end of the book. And I think the other story that you mentioned, October, that was maybe the one where dialect translating became hardest, because there's this scene at the end when the characters are speaking many, many dialects and many languages to each other. They're speaking Hokkien, they're speaking Sulawesi, they're speaking Japanese. I felt like I couldn't just put the words in and hope that people got the general sense of what they meant, because what they're saying is really horrifying insults. So it was important that the insults also came across. So in that instance, I think what I did was to usually include a transliteration of the words that they were saying, and then also include a kind of a gloss in terms of including the English insult. nearby or mixed in with the words. So I guess I don't really have a hard and fast rule for what to do when you encounter dialect and you have to translate it, or encounter another language and have to translate it. I think it is really dependent on what's happening in the scene at the time.
Okay. So this question is about the story Wall, and I realized that the first paragraph of this little story has been deleted. Is there any particular reason behind this?
There is, yeah. I'm kind of happy that you brought it up, because Wall was a really interesting story. So for anyone who hasn't read the book, it's this story that is about a town where a massive wall is built alongside an expressway that kind of blocks off all the houses. So all the houses that used to be along the road or the expressway suddenly have centimeters of space because this wall has come to block them out. And in the story, an old lady becomes very obsessed with creeping along this tiny gap looking for a cat. And the story is told from the perspective of a child. And this was the first story that I translated from the collection, before I ever had any ambition, I guess, to do the whole book. And so it was the first story that an editor looked at. And when he looked at the story, he seemed really unenthused about it. And I was kind of, surprised, because I really liked the story and I really liked Shufang's writing, and I didn't know why he was so unenthusiastic. And when we started talking about it, he said that the thing that was really bothering him was that the story was supposed to be narrated by a child, but very quickly, once the story has started, it moves to this kind of omniscient narration where the child somehow has the power to travel inside other people's houses and observe their lives with this also quite high register language that didn't seem to match the age the child is supposed to be, which is totally accurate and is something that I think in general in Chinese readers are maybe more willing to just suspend their disbelief about this kind of narrative trick. But in English, it didn't really work. And while we were talking, I was kind of flicking through the story and sort of seeing where these points came up. And it suddenly struck me that the only part of the story where it really suggests that it's being narrated by a child who is currently a child is the very first paragraph, where it says things like, "You might not believe this story because nobody believes children, but I don't care." And it just suddenly struck me that if we took those lines out, then actually it's still a story that someone experienced as a child, but it's more conceivable that they could be reconstructing it as an adult. So then we decided, okay, we're just going to take those lines out and let the story be a more of a reflection than a current child narration.
Yeah, just like you mentioned, the wall is narrated by a child. I think this point is quite important to me, because I neglected I realized that Andy, the word Andy, which is the word that the child used to address this just this female neighbor, and I didn't realize that this word is anti until I see your translation, because I thought it was an usual Chinese name, because it really seems like one. And when I see your translation, I suddenly understand it, because it makes a lot of sense to translate it into anti. Because first of all, in Chinese culture, if you're a child, it's quite impolite to address someone who is older than you directly by their names. So auntie mm-hmm. is quite polite. And this woman in this story, she's tend to be neglected or overlooked by others. So mm-hmm. I think it makes perfect sense if you don't give her a name, just give her something like auntie, something like that.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, did you realize this when you first read this novel?
Well, I think you raise a really interesting point, which is that I think Malaysian Chinese is quite different to Chinese that's written in Taiwan or mainland China or Hong Kong. So there is a very different quality to how the Chinese sounds. And when I first read this story, I think for the first few paragraphs, I noticed that I have underlined the Andy because I wasn't sure. I thought it sounded like it could be a name, maybe a Malay name or a transliteration of a name. It didn't sound to me like a Chinese name. And then on about the second page, I suddenly realized, because at the time I was working on the story, I was also reading a lot of books that had been written in English by Malaysian and Singaporean writers, including one book that I can recommend, which is by Anne Ang, and is called Bang My Car, which is written entirely in Singlish. And in these books, older men and women are referred to as auntie and uncle as a kind of common reference. So I think it was sort of in my head, and by the second page, it suddenly struck me that that was almost certainly what was happening in this story as well, and that the kid was calling this woman auntie rather than Andy or something.
Oh, okay. To be honest, I have still have a lot of questions to ask, but I think we are running out of time.
Sure. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was really nice talking to you.
Thank you very much, Carol and Natasha. We'll move over to Nikki and Via. I think that Via is having some connection problems. So Nikki, if we lose her, I'll just jump in for the Q&A. But I think you're going to start with a reading anyway.
I'm going to start with a reading, so hopefully she'll be back online again. So this is White Horse. You can all see it. Tiny little book, but a jewel. It's narrated. I mean, a lot of the stuff you two, Tasha and Shunya, have been talking about so resonates, because although a completely different book, a lot of the same questions came up. And this actually is narrated by a child, a girl growing into puberty, and she talks about her slightly older cousin and the relationships between her cousin, her uncle and aunt, her father, and her mother has died. But it's far more complicated than that. At this stage in the story, things are relatively simple. She's very annoyed with her cousin because her cousin is growing up and has more or less abandoned her. They used to do everything together. And now she's just a little squit, and her cousin's very grown up. So she sneaks into her cousin's room, and I'm going to read from here on. So she's in her cousin's room, and she's emptied out her cousin's school bag. I decided to take 10 cents and a red rubber band because she'd hurt me. A little while later, I found her letters. The letters were in the lining of her school bag. And as soon as I looked, I knew they were love letters. One began, "Dear Ching." My heart went pitter-patter, and I strained my ears for any noise outside. But my cousin was still out, and my auntie was in the kitchen. She called to ask if I wanted an apple, and I said, "No, thanks." Once I'd finished, I'd read one letter. There was another, half finished, which was her reply. "Dear Feng," it began, "my cousin was in love. By the time she returned, I put everything back, even the coin and the rubber band. But I was still in her room, and she asked warily, 'Yunyun, what are you doing?' 'Just reading,' I held up my book innocently. She came over and picked up her school bag. 'Did you move this?' She looked suspicious. 'No.' 'Just you leave my school bag alone,' she said severely. 'Okay,' I said. My cousin and her boyfriend had said they'd, quote, meet after school by the sports ground parallel bars. So I went and leaned over the balcony, hoping to catch a glimpse of him. I saw my cousin casting suspicious glances up at the balcony, but she didn't see me. My uncle's beloved orchid plants were so bushy, I could duck down behind them. From up here, now I think I'm going to skip a bit so I can get, so this is, she carries on looking, the boy turns up, and the couple, Jiang Qing and the boy, they look embarrassed, but after a while, they drew closer and started strolling around together. Sometimes they went around twice, sometimes five times, and sometimes were only halfway around before they secretly entwined hands. And so on, and then she catches them. I saw a couple with their arms around each other, kissing on the mouth. They really were kissing on the mouth, because their arms were around each other and their heads were side on. Just like in the films, engrossed, I leaned over to gape at them. When I pulled myself together, my cousin had gone, and my mouth was full of cold air. Ching came home and asked my auntie, "Where's Puyun?" "Doing her homework in your bedroom." She came in looking like a thundercloud. "You're so crafty," she said. I realised she must have seen me. "I won't tell anyone," I said. The way she looked at me, I thought she was going to give me a slap. But she just said, "You're not allowed to tell the grown-ups. Otherwise, I'll never speak to you ever again." I knew we were back together again when she told me his name was Ye Feng and his parents had jobs in the county town labour department. Then she said, "We're going out on Sunday, you can come too." At dinner, she told her parents, "On Sunday, I'm going out with Yun Yun." "You spend all day wandering around," grumbled my uncle. "It'll be your final exam soon." I protested my auntie, "Let them go out and have a bit of fun. Just don't be back late." When Sunday came, my cousin and her boyfriend strolled by the river with me bringing up the rear. They were hand in hand. After we'd been twice up and down the riverbank, I'd had enough. "Ching, I can't walk anymore," I called. "Then stay here and wait for us," she said. I sat on the riverbank and they disappeared. I knew they must be sitting somewhere out of sight, kissing. I threw a stone, then another. Then I picked up a really big one and smashed it down into Bright Creek as hard as I could. It was getting dark when I started to call my cousin. "Ching, Ching, where are you?" Up and down the riverbank I went, but she still didn't appear. I seemed to see something in the eucalyptus trees on the other side and screamed even louder, "Zhang Qing, Zhang Qing." The thing emerged from the trees. It was a white horse. I burst into tears.
I've got can everyone hear me? I was just adjusting my for connection and sorry for not showing my face because this way it's like the connection will be better. So I will just go ahead with our discussion and agree that many of the discussions Carol and Natasha resonated with what's going on here in Whitehorse. They have included the dialect and the confusing context of family relationships, and that's exactly what's happening here. But I will try to cover some very different questions. So I think it might be a good idea to start with the main character of the story. So Nikki, you've mentioned in the reading that there is a white horse, and actually the white horse has happened about seven times in the story at different points. And this is about, I guess, the second time. But I think there's a very interesting thing here is because Yun, the little girl in the story, she saw white horses, but others couldn't see it. And if we come to think about the role vision play narrative, we have the feeling that although Yun is recounting everything the language of a child, she sees the world around with the eyes of a writer, with so many details, fresh and naked, creating indeed the impression of what she said at one point, that she is omniscient and omnipotent. And these are actually the two words you use in your translation. And this reminded me of an early interview in which you mentioned that the strength of Yenge's writing is her ability to inhabit the character and his or her humanity. So I wonder if this is a case in which you feel like Yenge has taken over the narrative, inhabiting not just the girl's eyes, but her voice too. And a related question. In most cases, there seems to be a distance between the voice and the eye, between the lightness of Yun's tone and the bizarre reality she sees in the world around her, the white horse being the most striking example. And does this pose any challenges to your translation of the text? Thank you.
I think you've observed it all really well. Actually, I think one of the strengths of the story is that I saw it completely differently, and I think you can, because of the way Yenge writes, you can interpret what she's writing in different ways. So, no, I felt that of all the books I've ever translated, this one most clearly represents the voice of the child and not the author's voice. And I couldn't tell you exactly why. That was just the way I read it. And also the translating of it. I suppose the biggest challenge was to recreate the voice of the child. I mean, I'm not a child anymore. But it was a completely immersive experience. It was something that I just kind of got into it and did it without analyzing it and without thinking about it. I think one of the things about translating a young person or a child's voice is you've got to get the register right. And I did wonder when you pointed out to me that I described her, she's the girl Union is saying about herself. When she's on the balcony, she's omniscient and omnipotent. She knows everything, she sees everything. That's quite high register. And I kind of wondered, too late now, but there's always different choices. Maybe I should have made it a bit lower register. And then I thought, actually not. She's an old enough child and she's well educated enough that the words, as they come over in the Chinese and in the English, they kind of fit. But on the whole, the story is just coming out of her mouth and her mind, but that's my view. And I can see why you see it in a different way. One of the interesting things about Yenge, and I found this with Chili Bean Pei's clan, Wo Menjia, her rather more, how shall I say, a grown-up novel about badly behaved grown-ups. Is that I asked her, I had to ask her a couple of times how she saw the ending. And she said, I like to leave it a bit open. I like the readers to work really hard. I'm not going to tell them everything. And you've mentioned riddles, and I would describe it as the threads of the story or the clues or the riddles. And there are lots of them. But the odd thing is that when I got to the end of White Horse, I was quite clear what had happened. But maybe that's me looking at it as a grown up, and I don't know how a teenager would receive the story. I mean, to me, it's about mental illness, and I just love to give lots of examples, but I can't spoil the plot, so I can't give you too many examples. But it's about her, to me, it's about her mental illness. But then you say, well, would a child write about her mental illness in that way? Probably not, but it really does feel like it all comes out of her head. Next question.
Thank you, Nikki. Yeah, I agree with you. Like, there are multiple ways of reading Yun's language and also the White Horse main name. And I think we got a feeling of how Yun has become more and more like her mother by the end of the story. And it's really a haunting feeling. But I think for me, like, I got this feeling that the White Horse is really uncompromising physical intrusion instead of a mental figure. But yeah, that would be something that I will have later in the discussion. So my next question would be, so you've mentioned about the riddles of the story. Actually, the riddles is mostly centered on Yun's identity, or more precisely, on the relationships between Yun, her father, and her cousin's family. And one aspect we would associate with identity when we talk about it is how we address each other in and between families. And we've got a lot of appellations in the story, uncle, auntie, cousin, in which in the Chinese the word is actually sister. And we have to negotiate between how they see each other and how the neighbors call see this family. And I've noticed, as we have discussed earlier, that there are differences between these two contexts of family relationships and the relationship between the Anglophone world and the Chinese world. So I wonder, like, these different whether like this difference is whether it will pose a challenge to your translation of these riddles and reversals in their story, because it was so relevant to the whole narrative effect. And despite these differences,
like in appellation, in the use of personal pronouns, despite all those differences, how you manage to retextualize the layering and surprises, you also prepared for the reader in this complicated network of relationships.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on a really good point. The whole novel is about these peculiar relationships that the girl, as she grows up, learns more about. But the way you describe relationships in Chinese is just not the same way you read them in English. I think Tasha mentioned about it was Chunyan, about the fact that it's very impolite for a child to call an older person by their given name. So you call them uncle and auntie. And I think as translators, we constantly come across this problem. When you read this in Chinese, how are you going to translate it in English? Because the English reader will automatically, unless they give it a good think, they're going to think, oh, that really is her uncle, her aunt, and her cousin. And this is one of the ambiguities which is actually part of the story. Normally it isn't. So normally, if you have someone talking about Auntie Ma or something, you could translate that as Mrs., because that would also be respectful for a younger person to call an older person Mrs. or Mr. But in this story, it's all to do with how these people really are or are not related to each other. So I think it's an insoluble problem. I kept the auntie and the uncle because it was clear that that was the kind of relationship she had with them. And I think that at the beginning of the story, she really does believe that those are her uncle and aunt. Maybe it doesn't actually matter. She never asks to she never asks herself, so is that my father's brother? Is he that kind of an uncle? I just don't think it works like that in Chinese. And I don't think it needs to work like that in English. But as regards the trail that Yenge is laying, that we have to follow as we follow the clues, and eventually we get to the end of the story and we make up our own mind about what's really happened, I'm not sure you can actually reproduce that in English. I think you probably, it's a bit like going through a maze. Maybe in the Chinese there's one way through the maze, and in English there's another way through the maze, but you come to the same point in the end when you come out of the maze. In other words, you come to the same conclusions about what has gone on between the adults and what actually happened to Yunyun's mother, and so on. So I think this is probably the story that I've translated that has the most challenging difficulties about trying to reproduce the clues. And I can only ask people to read the story and see whether they think it all makes sense. But I don't think you can ever really reproduce the exact clues that were in the Chinese, because it mentions different family relationships that you simply can't translate into English. Different kind of aunties and different kind of uncles, that just doesn't work in English.
Thank you, Nikki. I agree with you. I agree with you. Like, we have different clues, and you have to really relocate, try to rearrange the clues rather than reproducing it. And I did feel, in a way, when I'm reading your translation, like it did surprise me in many points, though I've read the Chinese ones. It's really a good experience to move between the two texts. And one more question is about the conclusion that you have mentioned. Like, we have different conclusions, but we have reached a conclusion at the end of the story. And at the end of the story, the line goes, 然后我要读初中, 我现在可以耍朋友,也可以不耍,没哪个要管我了. And the English goes like, I couldn't remember them exactly, but it feels like Yun said to herself, like, I can't really feel confident, like other guys will ever like me. Like, she was meaning that in the English test, she was meaning like she won't have a boyfriend after all, because everything happened on her. I think that was a really different register compared to what I understood in the Chinese test, and I'm really curious about your consideration behind this conclusion or the feeling we are left with. Yeah.
I didn't mean to give it a different register. I'd have to compare the Chinese and the English. I mean, I've got the English in front of me. I haven't got the Chinese in front of me. I think there is a really tricky problem between Chinese and English. And I certainly didn't mean deliberately to make a change. I mean, I know it's people often... It's often said that the translator is a traitor and can do anything they want with the author's original text. On the whole, all the translators I know are very ethical and actually don't make these kind of changes. So I wouldn't have deliberately changed the register at all. Because I think the register belongs to the author, and what I'm trying to do is to recreate, not an exact match, because you can never have an exact match, but try to recreate what's going on in the author's head and recreate a new version so that the readers in English will get the same impression.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I let you make you feel like I'm meaning that you are making deliberate renditions. No, I don't think you are making revisions. Just like the Chinese line is quite ambiguous, and the English line reads, and maybe it's because my reading is too definite. I think that the English line is longer than I have remembered. It's just an interesting thought to put on, yeah, to round up the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's very, very interesting to actually go back and have an editor's eye or a very close read like you were doing between two texts and think, actually, how could I have done that differently? And it's a discussion that would never end because there are so many different possibilities. There's never only one right answer. How much time have we got? Because I wouldn't mind saying another couple of things.
Yeah, we've got 10 minutes. You've got a few minutes, Nikki, just so that we have some time to open up to questions from. But yeah, no, we have a few minutes. Please do take them.
I'm gonna kill the phone anyway. I just wanted to finish by saying something that Yaji and I didn't actually discuss, but it's the way in which there isn't a lot of dialect in this story, but there are other really interesting things going on which show not so much that it's from an area which speaks dialect, but from a time when social and sexual values were very different in China from what they are now, and certainly from what Western young readers or Western adult readers would be used to reading. And I thought this was hilarious. There's a mention that kissing on the mouth only happens in films, foreign films, and it's a dirty habit, which was quite funny. And then there was something which I think that young people all over the world have thought at one time or another, that the thought that their elders, their elder relatives or parents were doing anything like that was totally disgusting and horrible to think about. And that is actually what Yunyun says. You know, she couldn't, or was it? No, it was Qing. She couldn't imagine auntie and uncle doing anything like that. They're much too old. And that just made me, I couldn't help smiling when I read it, because I haven't read it since the book, since I finished translating the book. And I'd forgotten that sentence. And that is so what, you know, probably what I thought as a kid. My God, these things never happen. You know, they can't possibly be doing that. So I thought that that was one of the things, that this is not a completely bleak book. It is incredibly funny in bits. Other than, yeah, so I think that was what I wanted to conclude on. Thank you. And thank you, Yashi, for your very interesting questions.
Thank you, Nikki.
Can we open up to questions from people attending? You can use this little raise hand function at the bottom if you'd like to ask a question. I have plenty of questions if nobody jumps in, but let's see if anyone would like to start. I wonder, Natasha and Nikki, while people are thinking, if you could say something about how easy you find it or not easy these days to place Chinese language literature with English speaking publishers. Do you feel there's been a shift there? Is it a struggle? Is it easy? What are your experiences?
Difficult.
Yeah, I think Nikki, I haven't been translating for that long, only for about 5 years. So Nikki, you probably have more insight into whether it's shifted to become better than it was before. I like to think perhaps there's more openness and sort of willingness to entertain literature from Chinese than previously, but I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I have good days and bad days. On bad days, I get very pessimistic and think that actually the fashion is for books translated from Japanese and Korean, and nobody loves Chinese books. But of course, that's not entirely true. I mean, over the last, like, since I started translating, 20 years, good things and bad things have happened. Way more translators, way more translations, lots of small independent publishers are publishing books from Chinese. So that's all the good stuff. The not so good stuff is that the economic situation is really bad. There are hardly any grants available. Translators have got to make a living. That immediately bumps up the price of publishing a book for a publisher. So, you know, the economic situation is really difficult, and it is sometimes quite difficult to market some Chinese books because they speak about an experience which is very different from what most Western readers would expect to read about. And I would completely exempt our two books from that. I think our two books are amazingly accessible and appealing.
I don't know, because I was thinking, as I don't want to interrupt you, sorry, I just wanted to jump in on the idea that the books are talking about experiences that people aren't expecting. Do you mean that because people are expecting a book about the Cultural Revolution and as soon as they don't get that, they don't want it? Or do you mean that there aren't books that are not about the Cultural Revolution? Because I do think that definitely in the last few years, there have been so many translators working on writers from Taiwan or Hong Kong or a few from Malaysia that are just showing, just writing that, to me, doesn't seem rooted necessarily in particular countries, but they're just talking about literary experiences. That makes me quite happy, because I feel like it means you can't call literature from Chinese a genre in itself anymore, which seems great, because it's not, obviously.
I think the variety of, what's it called, Sinophone writing, amazing and fantastic. And I quite regret that I don't have a broader range of reading myself, but I do mostly translate writers from the mainland. But even there's a huge variety. It's just a question of persuading publishers that there is that variety. I think Bad Boys in the City books.
Oh, God.
I don't particularly like them, but publishers do seem to like them. And then there are the countryside epics, which I think readers can find quite challenging, but which some of the best writers in China write, and write incredibly well. You just do have to work a little bit harder to get into them, because they tend to be quite long, and they speak about experience of living in the countryside, which is something that most of us don't experience nowadays. But yeah, I mean, the best thing is there's just a huge variety.
Do we have any questions? Dee?
Oh, hi, Nikki and Natasha. First, like, based on your answer to the last question, I really want to thank you for your contributions to promoting Chinese literature in this Anglophone world, because before, like, the Anglophone writing or the books, most of them just try to suit the Western readers, like, their taste, and to consolidate the stereotypes of China. And I'm really surprised by the recent publications of Paper Republic that they cover a wide range of topics, and they are all very interesting. And back to my question, I noticed that Nikki, you have translated some works of Jia Pinghua and also works of Yan Ge. I think they must have very different styles. And I just want to ask if when you translate their works, do you do any like conscious adjust to your writing style or, you know, your voice like that?
That's a nice question. I think I become like I can't remember the word. The voice comes from inside myself, and I certainly don't do it consciously. I certainly hope that you would not read my various translations and think, oh, that was definitely by Nikki because she always uses the same words. So I do try to immerse myself, and it kind of, it happens unconsciously. I don't need to sit down and think, oh, well, this story is high register, that one is low register. So it's very important to me to get a good range of voices and to recreate the author's voice, like the Jia Pinghua novel Happy, translated as Happy Dreams. He's a trash collector, and the whole story is told in his words. And apart from the difficulties of dialect, I really needed to know that I was going to be able to recreate the voice of a rubbish picker. But I don't do it as a conscious exercise. If it works, it comes from inside me.
I think that reminds me, I think I've heard this said by other people, not just me, that I think a really big part of translation is also listening to the text. So, I mean, the text is giving you that raw material. I think that the text is in a particular tone, then if you're reading it attentively, then of course it makes sense that your English will kind of match it or be appropriate for it.
Thank you. Oh, that's very interesting to know that, because sometimes, like, me also do some translations. So when I translate some like male's work from like reading in a male voice, I feel sometimes awkward because maybe I'm too female conscious. But yeah, it sometimes happens. So I have to choose like to adjust my voice to make it not too, I don't know. But sometimes, yeah, it do come from ballets. But yeah, I remember you mentioned that last time. But yeah, I think sometimes if we feel some awkwardness in our reading or translation, then maybe we should be more focused on this point and the differences it might indicate. That's my point. Hope that helps. But anyway, thank you so much for your answers.
Nikki and Natasha, that was one of the fastest 60 minutes I've ever experienced. It flew by, and I think I would be very happy to sit here for at least another 60 minutes and keep talking, but we have to bring this to a close. I can say, Natasha, I've just started reading Like a Mirror. Oh. I'm only two stories in, and as a cat lover, the first story is very disturbing. That's all I will say.
Yeah, it's true. And also a cat lover. When I went to visit her, she introduced me to her cats, so I I hope they're okay.
she has more than one cat. Is this a multiple?
She does have more than one cat.
And I read White Horse last night, which I can highly recommend to everybody. It's a very quick read. I think it took me an hour, maybe. It completely blew me away, Nikki. I think there's a, for me, I felt there was almost a bit of a disconnect between the illustrations and then the story that you find, yeah. Which immediately gets very disturbing. Quite sexual as well, which is not what you would expect in the cover. So if anyone is looking for something which I can't really describe it, but it is fascinating and will certainly take you to a different place for an hour, which at the moment I think is very, very welcome, I can recommend this. And Natasha, I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the stories in the collection. So thank you very much. Thanks also, a big thank you to Chun Yen and Ya Chi for preparing the questions and being in conversation with Nikki and Natasha. And we wish both of you good luck for Women in Translation next week, when we'll see you again, fingers crossed. And it was really, really great that you could be with us today. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you
for inviting us. Thank you, Nikki,
Natasha. Yeah, thank you everyone, it's been great.
Thanks everybody, bye-bye.
Bye.
I don't know how to sign off.
Wait a minute. Leave session.